course, one of the most iconic songs in the Simon and Garfunkel oeuvre. You're welcome. Comes from a movie from 50 years ago that is a genuine American classic. The movie, of course, was The Graduate with Dustin Hoffman and Anne Bancroft and Catherine Ross and a cast of other familiar names. Now for its 50th anniversary, Beverly Gray has written a book about it called Seduced by Mrs. Robinson. Beverly writes the Beverly in Movieland blog on her website, beverlygray.com, and also has written books about Ron Howard and Roger Corman and others in her career. And so I'm happy to have her join me here this afternoon. Hi, Beverly. How are you?
I'm fine. I'm really happy to be here.
Thank you. When this movie, The Graduate, came out, you were a senior at UCLA. And this,
yes,
this is a movie that takes place not far from UCLA. So I'm curious, since it's about a kid who was graduating college at 21, Benjamin Braddock, played by Dustin Hoffman, and you were just on the cusp of that yourself. When it first came out, how did the movie affect you?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question. I had had a really special junior year. I had gone on a junior year abroad program. I was living in Japan for that year and speaking a foreign language and learning about different cultures. And then I came home to my loving but rather controlling family. And, of course, they welcomed me with open arms and started telling me all the great plans they had for my future, and how they thought it would be just great if I went to law school, and how they just assumed I'd be getting married one of these days. And they had it all figured out. And I knew they had the very best of intentions. But this was the 60s. This was a time when people were looking around to make their own kind of mark and their own kind of decisions. And that's what I wanted to do, too. So I knew in those early party scenes exactly how Dustin Hoffman felt.
You were the female equivalent of Benjamin Braddock in your own life.
Well, I did not have an affair with my father's partner's wife. And in fact, my sex life was pretty uninteresting. But in terms of the relationship to one's parents, yes, I knew what he was feeling.
Did anyone ever say the word plastics to you?
No, I think they thought of me as doing more intellectual things than that. So plastics weren't anything I was worried about, but law school definitely was.
All right.
And while other people were taking drugs and picketing in the streets, I was a upright kind of kid. I didn't do those things, but I said to my parents, I'm going to grow my hair and I'm not going to go to law school. So there you have it.
All right.
My rebellion.
Here's where I want to start as we discuss The Graduate. At the end, because I've shown this daughter, this movie to my daughter, and who is a recent college graduate herself. It didn't quite have the same impact as it did on you in 1967 on her, but we had a long discussion of the last scene. Now, for people who have seen The Graduate, they know about the iconic moment of Dustin Hoffman's Benjamin Braddock banging on the glass inside the church, yelling out Catherine Ross's character's name, Elaine, 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 and then he finally gets her away from the altar where she's about to take her vows and get married.
She actually has taken her vows, which was a little unusual, yes.
Oh, I forgot that she, did she actually say, I do?
That she actually had, yes.
Oh, okay. But nonetheless, he grabs her and they run out of the church, she in her wedding gown, he in this kind of beat up garb he had just been wearing all day long to try to get there. And they run out and they get on a city bus and they go to the back of the bus and all the people are looking at them and they don't say a word. They just sit there and they're laughing like, wow, look at what we've just done. This is fantastic. And then the laughter abates and there are looks on their faces that say, what, Beverly?
Let's say, who are we and what are we doing? And this is what Mike Nichols kind of had in his head. He thought that Elaine, after a few miles, would say, you know, I've got nothing to wear. And, of course, they do have nothing to wear, and they don't have careers. They don't have money. They don't have anything. They've made the bold gesture, and now what? So I guess that would be what I would say more than anything, now what? And what's so interesting about that moment is it was kind of accidental. It's not in the script, and it's not in anything that he told his actors. Mike Nichols, this was at the end of a very long and arduous shoot, he said to his two actors, who were very tired at this point, okay, we've got traffic blocked for 20 blocks. We've got a police escort. This is costing us a fortune. So get on that bus and laugh, goddammit. And with that kind of instruction, They really did try. They tried to be happy and delighted with themselves and joyous and jubilant and in love, and they beamed and they clapped their hands with glee. And then no one said cut, so they didn't know what to do next. And that is really what you see reflected on film. Mike Nichols saw it in the editing room and said, that's it. That's the ending that I want.
Did Mike Nichols forget to say cut, or did he purposely not say cut?
Apparently this is what happened. He was not on the bus. The people on the bus included a man named Sam Osteen, who was the film editor and who worked very closely with Nichols. And he was wired so that he'd get Nichols' message. And he was supposed to be the one who relayed the cue to cut.
Mm-hmm.
He did not get that message, so the scene went on and on and on. And Nichols had said something very interesting about it. He said, this was the ending that was created by my subconscious, and I didn't know what I was doing, but I guess I did.
It is a brilliant, brilliant ending to the movie. Now I want to go back just a little bit, back inside that church. Tell me how hard it is for Mike Nichols, as the director of that movie, to convince the actual church fathers to allow him to shoot in there and have Dustin Hoffman banging on that glass, which would not make anybody happy, I'm guessing.
Absolutely right. So the person to whom it fell to argue with the church fathers was Larry Turman, the producer of the movie, kind of a forgotten man in all this, but a man who had everything to do with making this project go. And he was delegated because Mike Nichols had seen the picture of this church. And if you notice, all through the film, The Graduate, there is all kinds of glass and all kinds of transparent barriers. So when he saw pictures of this church, he thought, this is perfect. This is what I want. This is what I'm going to have. So Larry Turman had to persuade the church fathers and elders, and he somehow made a speech that convinced them. He said, this is about some tough issues. This movie, it goes out on a limb, but it's talking about things that we and in the world of faith should be talking about. Somehow he talked them into it. But there's Dustin Hoffman up there wanting to pound on this glass, and the glass in probably a choir loft was the gift of some wealthy parishioner. And the head of the church, the pastor, was very, very anxious about this glass getting broken. And at that point, he got really nervous and he said, all of you out. I don't care what we've agreed to. I don't want you here anymore. Which was the point at which they realized that something had to be done to protect that glass. So if you notice, you think of Benjamin as pounding, but he's not. He's got his hands spread wide, and he's kind of tapping on the glass, looking very anxious, but he's not hitting it with the full force of his fist.
Uh-huh.
He's tapping it with his fingers. And the really funny thing that happened was a lot of people, particularly people who didn't like the movie and were prepared to be offended by it, thought that this was Mike Nichols' cheap attempt at a crucifixion image, and this is Ben as a Christ figure.
No.
And then there he was with his arms out, and oh my God. So some pretty nasty things were said about that moment, even by some major critics, but nobody had that in mind. It was simply to protect the glass.
It was just a coincidence of good location scouting.
Yes, it was, indeed.
Yeah. All right, now let's talk about the cast here. And before we get to Dustin Hoffman and Catherine Ross, let's talk about Anne Bancroft, who I believe was the first of the three major roles to be cast, right?
Yes, she was. And you have to understand, when you make a small movie and you want people to go see it, it really helps to have a big name in that movie. So they were looking for a name for that part. And one of the first names they came up with was really unlikely. Producer Larry Turman had always liked the idea of casting against type, of doing something so wild and different that people would want to go see it. And so he got the bright idea of sending the original novel of The Graduate to none other than Doris Day, famous, of course, for playing perky virgins in a lot of romantic comedies.
Yeah.
He thought, this could be interesting. And she has always said that she turned down the role. She was offered the role. She turned it down. It offended her values. Larry Turman is very insistent that she never actually was offered the role, and that she never actually even read the novel because her husband, who was a controlling kind of guy, he was also her manager, withheld it from her. So in any case, she didn't play the part, needless to say, nor did Jeanne Moreau. Briefly, they thought about the idea of a French actress like that. It seemed to fit, but then they decided it was too much of an American story and that introducing another nationality would change things up in a way they didn't want. They thought about Patricia Neal, who has, like Anne Bancroft, a kind of a sultry quality and was very talented, but she'd had a stroke. And they thought of Ava Gardner. Mike Nichols apparently went to see Ava Gardner, who was still somewhat retired, but still very, very beautiful. And he started to talk to her, and she started talking about how she planned to call up her friend Ernest Hemingway for a chat. And Ernest Hemingway had been dead for 5 years at that point, so
yeah,
it was confirmed for Mike Nichols that she was just not exactly mentally up to this.
Okay, so he ends up with Anne Bancroft after going past all of those other options. All of those other women you just mentioned, by the way, older than Anne Bancroft, and Anne Bancroft here playing Elaine's mother, Mrs. Robinson, she was not that much older than Dustin Hoffman at the time, right?
That's right. The role should be played by someone who's about 40. She was more like 35, so she was younger. Dustin Hoffman was just turning 30, so they were very close in age. Of course, he looked young and played young, and she was made up to look older than, in fact, she was. A story I really like is that, you know, Mike Nichols didn't really want her to be distressed by how old he was making her look. So she never saw dailies. She never saw the film until it was complete. And when she did see it, she was very disheartened at how unattractive she looked. But she said years later, she went back and saw it again and thought she was the most gorgeous thing she'd ever seen.
She was.
She was gorgeous. She was truly gorgeous.
Yeah.
And it took her a few years to realize that fact.
All right, now let's talk about Dustin Hoffman. And the interesting part of the Dustin Hoffman story is Anne Bancroft was, and I didn't know this until I read your book, and I'm not going to spoil it. I'm going to let you tell the story. But Anne Bancroft was married to the legendary Mel Brooks. And Dustin Hoffman was going to work for Mel Brooks on another project at the time, right?
Yes. Common wisdom is that Dustin Hoffman had never been in a movie before. That's not quite true. Not only did he have a teeny, few-second role in a little indie with Ann Jackson and Eli Wallach, but he had also starred in a absolutely zero-budget kind of caper movie in which he kind of does some Jerry Lewis shtick, believe it or not. And that nobody, fortunately, has ever seen this movie because his career would be in the toilet if they'd seen it. It's really awful.
Yeah.
But he had gotten to know Mel Brooks, and Mel Brooks was just then getting together the money to make his first film, The Producers. And he seriously wanted Dustin Hoffman, who was kind of an off-Broadway fixture at that point, to play one of those wacky roles, not a lead, but a wacky featured role of the neo-Nazi playwright.
Franz Liebken.
Yes, that's right, exactly right.
Yeah.
Franz Liebken. That's who he was going to play. And the story goes, and this was something that was told to a colleague of mine very recently by Mel Brooks, that Dustin Hoffman came to him. They knew where one another lived in Greenwich Village. He didn't have a phone number, so he tapped on his window. Mel Brooks came out, and Dustin Hoffman said, "I'm sorry, I can't be in your movie because I've just been cast in this movie, The Graduate." And Mel Brooks, showing great indignation, said, "You mean you're not going to be in the movie I've been trying 10 years to get financed, and instead you're going to spend all summer in bed with my new beloved wife?" And then he paused and he said, "Good choice."
I don't know if the story's true or not, but it's a great story.
It is a great story.
Yeah, I love that. And, of course, the third part of the triumvirate in that movie is Catherine Ross. And it's funny that we're talking about this today after 2 months of all these stories about sexual harassment in Hollywood and elsewhere, because you say in the book that she was subject to that at the hands of one Dustin Hoffman.
Yeah, and again, it's a story. One thing you learn when you work on something like this is you're going to hear the same story many, many times, but it comes out differently each time. So I don't know what the truth is, but apparently out of friendliness or impishness or nervousness or whatever it was during the audition, which they did together. There was a full day of audition just to be, I don't know, friendly or who knows what. He sort of pinched her on the bottom, and she whirled around and said, "Don't ever do that again."
Mm-hmm.
So he didn't.
All right, we've talked about the three stars. We've talked about the director. I could actually spend another 2 hours talking to you about this movie because we would have to work our way through Buck Henry and, you know, the supporting cast of William Daniels and Alice Ghostly and Richard Dreyfuss and Catherine Wilson and Norman Fell. But I started this off with Mrs. Robinson, the song by Simon and Garfunkel. And I want to talk to you a little bit about their involvement in this, or how Mike Nichols decided that they would effectively be the soundtrack for his movie.
That's right, and it was something quite unusual. This is what happened. They were, of course, very popular and really seemed to kind of capture the feeling of young people like me in that era. Their sound was sweet and melodious, but very melancholy, and he thought that was just right. His brother had given him an album, and he found himself playing it a lot while he prepared for his days on the set. So it seemed the right kind of music. So he commissioned Paul Simon to write three original songs for the film. One song was completed. It's a song that did end up on one of their albums. It's called Punky's Dilemma, and it doesn't do much for me now, and it didn't do much for Mike Nichols then. But they also said, Paul Simon also said that, well, he was working on a little something. He hadn't gotten very far, and it was called Here's to You, Mrs. Roosevelt. And Mike Nichols thought, there might be something there. And Roosevelt became Robinson, and the connection between Eleanor Roosevelt and Mrs. Robinson, who knows? But that became a little snatch of a song. It's not a complete song that's in the movie. But the dominant songs in the movie, the one that you hear at the beginning, you hear at the end, you hear at great length in the middle, is The Sound of Silence.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting about that, I talk about a mournful, eerie song, a song where the lyrics are not exactly right. There's lyrics like, "I turn my collar to the cold and damp." Now, that is not Southern California in the middle of summer.
No.
But somehow the mood seemed to suggest the mood of what was going through a Benjamin Braddock's head as he headed back to his homestead in Southern California. So this song and some of the others, like Parsley, Sage, Rosemary, and Thyme, were used in the editing room as temp tracks to score the film by the film editor. And it suddenly occurred to Mike Nichols that these were the right songs. Why try to compose something else when you had the right thing right in front of you? So they put these songs into the movie, and the financier, whose name was Joseph E. Levine, he of Hercules Unchained fame, he imported that from Italy to the U.S., Steve Reeves. Joseph E. Levine knew a great deal about box office, and he was indignant. He said, "You can't do this. You can't use old music." It was about 2 years old. He said, "You can't do it. You're going to be laughed out of the theater. These are old songs." And Mike Nichols said, "I can do it. I want to do it." And, of course, what he ended up doing was changing the course of the movie soundtrack, because what he had done, somewhat unconsciously perhaps, was picked songs for which that everyone already had in their heads, where everyone already had their associations, and they brought that emotion into the movie theater with them. And since that time, an awful lot of filmmakers have gone about things in exactly the same way, using old songs as a way to call up an era, to call up some emotions. It works beautifully, and it works all the time.
The movie was nominated for 7 Oscars: Picture, Director, mm-hmm. Actor, Actress, Supporting Actress, Screenplay, Cinematographer. Only won one award from Mike Nichols for Best Director, and it is a real icon of American movie history. The movie is The Graduate. The book is called Seduced by Mrs. Robinson, written by Beverly Gray, who you can find online at beverlygray.com and read her Beverly in Movieland blog a couple of times a week. It's been a real pleasure having you on the show today, Beverly. Thanks for sharing your stories.
Thank you. It's a delight to be here, and I wish you the best.
Thank you. I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.